It's the third Sunday of Lent on the Christian calendar, a time of prayer and reflection and even fasting as Christians prepare ourselves to worship on the coming Good Friday and Easter Sunday. Lent invites us to spiritually turn ourselves inside out, to sit with God and examine the chaos inside of us, and then wait to see how God comforts us, what he shows us about where we are and who we are becoming. One of the Bible readings for this morning is Isaiah 55. It's a beautiful poem for us as we survey the chaos inside of us. God is speaking. In Hebrew, the poem begins starting in verse 1 with three comes. Come, you who are thirsty, come to the waters. Come not just for water, but also for the fine wine and the rich milk, even though you have no money, but somehow you can still buy it. It's an invitation from a friend to a feast, because in the Jewish culture, eating is the most intimate thing to do between friends. Then starting in the middle of verse 2, there are three listens. Listen and you will hear something rich and nourishing. Listen and pay attention to my voice and lean in. Listen and hear something that will revive your soul and give you life. In other words, God is about to deliver to us good news. So what is this about? Around the time when the Jewish people were putting their holy writings together, they've been doing some soul searching. It's been a tough few hundred years for them. Invaded by a foreign power, the Babylonians, who took possession of their land, gutted their wealth and their cultural identity. The king was captured and blinded and then shipped off to Babylon, the capital of the evil empire, along with all the capable young Jewish men like Daniel and his friends, to be weaned of their Jewishness and re-educated to serve the empire. The Babylonians were a cruel and hard master, but even more than the physical pain is the humiliation of defeat of a very proud people. This is the sadness and homesickness captured in Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered our homeland. There on the poplars, we hung our harps, and there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy, but they couldn't sing. The poet says their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouths. But through some unexpected world events, the Babylonians were themselves invaded by the Persians, and the Persian king didn't believe in exile. So while some people, like Esther, were content to live out their lives in Persia, a remnant of Jewish people, led by Ezra and Nehemiah, got support from the Persians to return to their land and rebuild their infrastructure. So now they're back, and they decided to write down and process their history as a people, which is when and how the Old Testament of our Bible came to be put together as we have it today. And as they reviewed their relationship with God, beginning with the creation story they heard as kids, and all the treaties and covenants God made with them through the ancestor Abraham, and then reaffirmed through Jacob and Joseph and Moses and King David, as they wrote things down on papyrus and wrote the sheets into scrolls, the pressing question was, what happened to us? How did we, God's chosen people, a successful and powerful nation under David, end up here? What went wrong? And exactly when and where did it all go wrong for us? I don't know what you do, but whenever bad things happen to me, I get a bit obsessive about pinpointing the moment when it all went wrong. A couple of months ago, my nephew in Hong Kong thought he pulled a muscle running for the bus, and that's why his leg was sore. It turned out to be way more serious. When his leg swelled up, he went to the emergency, and they found a blood clot in his 18-year-old leg. When he told his uncle, the poor kid got the third degree. I interrogated him because I wanted to know exactly how this happened so we could fix this and to not have it ever happen again. And maybe, too, some part of me wanted to know who was to blame. So I confess, I'm that kind of crazy person. I noticed that many years ago when I had a near miss in the car. And even though it wouldn't have been my fault, I nonetheless kicked myself for not leaving 5 minutes earlier or later to avoid the whole situation. Always, when bad things happen, I will mentally go back in time over and over, trying to pinpoint the exact moment when I entered hell because I missed the signs. And there's a point to doing that, to a degree, to learn from our mistakes and avoid repeating them. But really, though, it can get out of hand. As if the bad thing that happened wasn't bad enough, I will add to my misery by punishing myself for being so stupid, for not being smarter to steer away at the fatal moment. For the Jewish people, as they grapple with when it all went wrong for them, they pinpointed this moment at about 150 years before the invasion, when the Jewish people were led by a king named Ahaz. This was a time when Israel had split into two kingdoms. Israel was in the north and Judah was in the south. The menacing world power at this time was Assyria, a neighborhood bully going around picking fights with small countries that were no match for the big army. So the smaller countries, including Israel in the north, decided they should form an alliance, a kind of NATO, to fend off the evil empire together. But when the alliance approached Judah in the south to join, King Ahaz hesitated. It's not clear why he hesitated. It could just be that he had no appetite for war. Or some speculate that maybe he actually admired the Assyrians and was already regularly engaging in worship of the Assyrian gods, including sacrificing one of his sons in a fire ritual. So when he hesitated, the alliance against the evil empire took it as, if you're not for us, you're against us. So they launched an attack against Judah and King Ahaz. And it was a brutal war which Ahaz was losing. So it is at this moment Isaiah got a message from God for Ahaz. This is in Isaiah 7. Don't worry about the alliance or Syria, God says. I will protect you. And as a sign of reassurance, I will give you a son. You call him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. Every time you see the baby and you hear him cry, you will remember my promise to you. But Ahaz was not convinced, and instead he did something to secure his own survival. He went to the king of Assyria and asked for help against the alliance, which was basically unconditional surrender. Ahaz turned over all the wealth of Judah and willingly became a vassal state of the empire. He pretty much gave away the farm to save it. The king of Assyria was too happy to accept the money and deployed his forces against the alliance, which led to the defeat and exile of Israel, the North Kingdom. In the Assyrian records, the king wrote, I besiege and conquer Samaria, which is the geographic region which includes the North Kingdom, led away booty, 27,290 inhabitants of it, and impose on them the tribute of the former king. Those people led away were never heard from again. The tribes of the North Kingdom got assimilated and became the generic Samaritans. And Ahaz was an accomplice to the end of their cousins in the north. And then this happened, as recounted by a rabbi. Delivered from his enemies, Ahaz traveled to Damascus to thank his liberator and patron, the victorious Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. He was accorded the usual courtesy, but he was made aware of his status of dependence. In Damascus, Ahaz saw a famous heathen altar, which he admired so much that he had it copied and sent to Jerusalem to the high priest, and the command to put it up in the holy temple. And his return from Damascus, he himself sacrificed on this altar and forced the priest to offer the daily sacrifices on it. In order to satisfy the greed of Tiglath-Pileser, Ahaz continually despoiled of his treasures in the temple. Ahaz died in the 16th year of his most unfortunate rule. Both politically and spiritually, he had been instrumental in undermining the foundations of the kingdom of Judea. Heaven, too, did its share to spoil the last honors accorded him. On the day of his death, the sun shone for only 2 hours, so that his burial had to be rushed through. He was not buried with the other kings of the house of David. Ahaz led his people and sold out God from their friendship treaty. He didn't just doubt God's assurances. He sold his soul to the devil and gave away everything they treasured as a people, even their worship. This was the moment when everything went wrong. That rabbi's account was written in 1948, and you can still hear the pain and the shame in the retelling. So now, 200 years after Ahaz, after years of oppression under foreign rule, after identifying the epic moment of failure, when they as the people followed their king and turned away from their God and threw in with the enemy and gave the worship to foreign and oppressive gods only to falter badly, it is in the thick of that shame, of betrayal and failure, they heard the words of Isaiah 55 from God to them. Surprisingly, they're not condemning words or shaming words or angry words, which would have been totally justified if we have ever felt the sting of betrayal. But that's not what God said. Instead, they heard inviting words, welcoming words, forgiving words of mercy and comforting words that all will be well. And the message from God was that even though they turned away, even though you turned away from me, God says, and went your own way, I'm still here. And I am calling out to you to come, to turn back and return to me, where I have a banquet ready to feed you, to nourish you back to health, and to celebrate your return. Which sounds a lot like the point of Jesus' story about the prodigal son. They may have turned away from God. They have pinpointed the moment when it all went wrong. But the good news, the surprising news, is that God has not turned away from them. God has been right where he's always been, waiting for them to respond to his invitation to come back. So after the three comes and after the three listens, verse 3 finishes with a promise that despite them abandoning God and gave their worship to something else, the treaty that exists between them is still intact. God promises to restore David's bloodline to the throne, and they're still friends. God is determined to honor his end of the treaty. In Hebrew, verse 3, it says God's treaty with them is both with and for the people. God allies himself with people, not because he needs something from us. He enters into relationship because we need him. It has always been for the people's benefit. And that hasn't changed for the Jewish people, doesn't matter what they did. And when David's line is restored through someone Isaiah calls the servant, God's kingdom will rise again. But it will be a kingdom of all kinds of nationalities, not just Jewish people. That's verse 5. And then Isaiah says in verse 6, turn to God while he may be found, call on him while he's near. It sounds like Isaiah is saying God's invitation is a time-limited offer. But to my ear, it could also sound like he's saying is such an amazing offer. Why haven't you jumped at it? Why would you even hesitate? Turn back now, he says in verse 7, because God is merciful. Mercy is a surprise. When we have done something to anger someone, and they have every right to exact their pound of flesh as a payback, as a punishment, but instead, they surprise us with kindness. God is consistently merciful. He doesn't kick us when we're down. He doesn't throw us away when we fail him or when we abandon him. Instead, he comes to us when we hit bottom. He squats down with us in the dirt, and he's kind to us. Now, before we throw Ahaz under the bus for his epic fail, before we pat ourselves on the back for being better than he is, more faithful, more moral, and just better, we should probably acknowledge honestly that faith is hard. Trusting God is hard because we can't see the future and we're just doing the best we can with available information. To contend with our fight or flight instincts when we're scared to death. A while back, I saw a news story about all the complications of diabetes. It was quite a cautionary tale because it runs in my family on my mom's side. One of my uncle died young, having gone blind and suffered kidney failures at the end. And one part of that story, it's about the desperation of people waiting for a kidney transplant. How some people would go to the Philippines and buy a kidney from someone for just $6,000. People who do this rationalize that it's a win-win. The buyer gets a new lease on life and the seller can build a house in the slums. Except, of course, it's all illegal. And I find myself asking myself, if I ever needed a kidney and my time was running out, would I have the moral integrity to say no to this? Because it's wrong? Would I be willing to die for my moral convictions? Ahaz certainly had loyalty issues with God. But it's not easy to be brave when enemy tanks are rolling into town. Maybe we could have fared better than Ahaz, or even worse, who could say? The people writing things down a couple of hundred years later, though, definitely disapproved of Ahaz's actions, but they had the benefit of hindsight. In the moment, though, prophets have known to be wrong, too. So Ahaz hedged his bets, took matters into his own hands, and looked for a back door. So this was the moment it all went wrong. When people turned away from God and threw in with someone else, this was when they turned their backs on God. And now, the follow-up question is, has God turned his back on them? This is when God answers with Isaiah 55 and it's good news. God is still with them. In the caves where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, there was a complete scroll of Isaiah. That in the years before Jesus showed up, as the more devout Jewish people wondered about God and desperate to win God back to them, they hung on to these words of Isaiah's like a life raft. And they kept the scroll safe in the treasure vault like crown jewels as they searched the sky and waited for the servant to show up. They read these words out loud over and over, and when Jesus was born, when the angel told Mary and Joseph their baby was Emmanuel, when his disciples lived with him and watched him up close, they immediately recognized Jesus' life, his death, and his resurrection was Isaiah's words coming to life. Jesus was that servant in Isaiah. God himself born of a mother who had royal blood as a descendant of David. The language and symbolism of Isaiah's poetry, it's all over the New Testament because the people in Jesus' time knew Isaiah's words so well that they recognized Jesus was God making an old promise come true right before their eyes. Jesus is Emmanuel 2.0, the sign that God is still with them despite the epic fail the first time around. And it's all going to turn out all right. Because God has a new plan for saving and restoring not just the Jewish people, but all of creation. Jesus is Isaiah's servant who says, come and listen to good news. Think about how many ways an all-powerful God can bring about what he wants. As the theologian priest Robert Farrar Capon writes, if God wants to turn this messed up world into a city or a kingdom, why doesn't he just knock some heads together and put all the baddies under a large flat rock and get on with the job? Think about all the ways God can impose change on us or force us to behave and think in the way he wants. But he doesn't do any of that. Instead, he invites us, he takes the initiative, he calls out, and then he waits on us to choose how we will respond to his invitation. Because force has a whopping limitation, that theologian continues. If you take the view that one of the chief objectives in life is to remain in loving relationships with other people, outright power becomes useless. Humans like to get things done in a hurry. Faster, bigger, more power is always better. But sometimes we don't care who gets hurt or left behind in our hurry for results. So Isaiah 55 finishes with a reminder that God is not like us. He doesn't do what we do or the way we do it. And although he's far from us out there somewhere unreachable by human efforts, God is always the one who takes the initiative to reach out to us where we are, to draw near to us. And what he has for us, especially when we feel beaten up or worn down and deflated, it's a lifeline. The way rain is a lifeline for farmers. In the Old Testament, rain and running water is literally called living water. It is water that brings life, as opposed to dead water stewing in a barrel. This is how the Message paraphrases from verse 8. For as the sky soars high above earth, so the way I work surpasses the way you work. And the way I think is beyond the way you think. Just as rain and snow descend from the sky and don't go back until they've watered the earth, doing the work of making things grow and blossom, producing seed for farmers and food for the hungry, so with the words that come out of my mouth, not come back empty-handed. They will do the work I sent them to do. They will complete the assignment I gave them. So you will go out in joy. You'll be led into a whole and complete life. One of the lowest points on earth is in Southern California, 227 feet below sea level. In 1905, the Colorado River overflowed and overwhelmed some irrigation canals. Water flooded into the valley, and by the time they got the flooding under control, a giant lake was formed that was 45 miles long and 25 miles wide. They named it the Salton Sea, and people got excited. Over the next decades, farmers put in pumps to water the crops. Some people envisioned fancy resorts to rival Palm Springs. They put in fish that attracted pelicans and other birds. But there was a problem. The lake was a stagnant pool. There's no fresh water coming in and there's no outlet. So as people pulled out water and as the water evaporated and seeped into the ground, the lake got increasingly salty. That mixed with fertilizers from the farm, by the 60s, it was officially toxic. Entire population of fish and birds were dying, and a stinky breed of algae invaded the lake, giving off a smell of rotten eggs. No one knows how to fix this. There's a tourist site that says, go see this now before it all disappears. We have figured out how to send people to the moon, but to date, we have not figured out how to make rain. What the Salton Sea needs is fresh rain, which is a challenge with the drought in California. What will breathe new life into this body is living water. So as we continue with our inner reflection over Lent, Maybe among the chaos inside of us, we too find things that feel regretful, things that we're not proud of. Maybe we have done the autopsy and pinpointed the exact moment of our failure, leaving us discouraged, deflated, and in shame. And we feel like we need some refreshing rain to wash off the toxins. Isaiah tells us rain is coming. Because whenever we turn to God, after some unwise choices that landed us in a pit, what we get from God is not a kick to the backside, not a clap on the back, not a punch in the gut or a wake-up call or whatever kind of things we hear from football coaches. Instead, when we turn to God, He gives us refreshment and life-giving rain. So, on this third Sunday of Lent, we drop our armor. We turn ourselves inside out to survey the chaos and mess inside. We sit in it. We invite God into it with us. If any of us wonders how God feels about us, given how we may be feeling about ourselves, Isaiah reassures us that God doesn't base His love of us on whether we succeed or fail. God hasn't changed His mind about us or how He feels about us. Regardless of what mistakes we have made, what He has for us is good news. He invites us to come and listen for good news. He has living water to refresh us, nurse us back to health, and revive our souls. So, a moment for you to begin a conversation with God. And then Malcolm Guite. The psalm for this morning is Psalm 63, and this is Malcolm Guite. For love lifts time into eternity, kisses each passing moment into life, gives us a glimpse of your unfading glory. We fall away like every falling leaf, but even as we fall, we yearn for you. Our prayers are passing, our blessings brief, yet each one reaches deeply into you, for you yourself are reaching into us to breathe your life in us and make us new. The barren wasteland is made glorious with blossoms, breathing an eternal spring. And even as this first world fades from us, we step into the true world and we sing a joyful song, for there at last we see our heart's desire, our risen Lord and King. Amen.